Welcome to Arizona Quail Today, your go-to podcast for all things quail hunting in Arizona. We're dedicated to educating and inspiring the next generation of quail hunters. A big thanks to our supporters and proud partners, Arizona Outdoor Adventures, Fathers in the Field, and Marsupial Gear. Thanks for tuning in, and now let's dive into today's program.
Hey guys, Ryan Rice here with Arizona Quail Today. This is another episode on our new podcast, which is really fun. Today with me, we have Wade Zarlingo. Wade, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Ryan. Sure, it'll be fun.
We're sitting on the back porch, and Nate is our producer, and we're going to ask a series of questions. We've had folks that have already texted in some questions, and then I'll be checking on the Instagram as well. And so to be a part of the future kind of podcast conversation, you can direct message me on Instagram at azquailtoday. Check out all the information on azquailtoday.com. We should be on a platform near you for the upcoming podcast. We're hoping to unfold these about every 2 weeks. And so last podcast, we had Randy Babb, and today we're talking with Wade Zarlingo. So, Wade, tell us a little bit about, just in starting out, how you got into hunting, jumping into quail.
Yeah, no problem. I was fortunate enough. My dad was an avid hunter, so I basically grew into it, and it was something that I've always enjoyed, you know. And I used to bird hunt with a wrist rocket in Tucson in my backyard out in the desert, and might not be a legal means of take, but I was 8 years old, so you know, that's just the way it goes. That's how a lot of kids get introduced to hunting, is through those backyard activities and hiking around the desert. Anyway, so you know, I grew up hunting and big game hunting mostly, and dove hunting, and then ended up getting a lab when I was 10, and got into the dog training and did upland with the lab. And so I hunted a lot of gambles with a Labrador.
Wow.
And then duck hunted as well. And
was that how old were you at that point?
I was probably 13.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and I had a really good mentor that was a dog trainer that ran field trials, and then for a living he kind of taught how to teach obedience.
Who was that guy?
I can't even remember his name. Okay. I mean, it was so long ago.
I know that there was a couple legends that had kind of rolled through the valley.
Yeah.
During that same time frame.
Yeah. And then, you know, I was just fortunate. I just kind of, you know, kind of gravitated, and I was in the prime of hunting in the 80s when quail numbers were just insane. I mean, they were quail numbers like in the Orem Dugas area, which was fairly close to where I lived in Williams. We'd come down, and it wasn't uncommon to run into 10, 15 coveys of 30 plus birds within maybe 2 miles. It was unbelievable.
Now you go there and hunt all day long and right, maybe see 3 or 4 quail.
Not that bad. I was back in that exact same area this year, and I did find one big covey of birds, but it wasn't. They were spread out like every drainage off the main wash. You'd run into a separate covey of birds, yeah, you know. And when I was in there this year, there was one big covey and some real thick stuff, but it was a big covey. It was probably 40 birds, you know. And so those numbers are coming back, and it's these winter rains that drive that. And we've had will be our third year of pretty good winter rains.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And you hunt them, you see how those numbers come back fluctuate. And anyway, so, and then I love big game hunting. It's hard to get drawn, but I'm a meat hunter.
Yep.
And so I put in for cow elk, and I've been drawn. I've got 5 points for cow elk. So, that's all I've been putting in for. So now I'm going to have to probably change that tactic a little bit and kind of go for probably a bull, but it's more about the meat for me and just being outside, you know, hunting's always been a big part of what
I was. It a part of your family's life though? Was it something your dad, did you
just
say your
my dad and his brother? And, but my brother wasn't interested in hunting.
Yeah.
So out of the 4 siblings, I was the only one that kind of stayed with the hunting and continued.
And
to
your
do
dad
it.
Introduced you to it first.
So. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So I was fortunate, you know, and that's what I like about what you do. I mean, you're bringing kids into this and getting them out to where they can at least be out, even if they don't like to hunt. They understand the outdoors and appreciate the outdoors, which is a big deal. So
I read a statistic the other day, 50% of today's youth is growing up without a dad in the home, 50%. And so, I mean, the impact that that has is just incredible. You know, I was talking to my dad this morning about we're doing a podcast coming up on Mother's Day. I'm going to have my mom on the program and talk about why it's important for mothers, how they mother the boys and and the family, live in the family of hunters. You know, and my wife, when we first got married, she was like, I knew I was going into, I'm a full-time pastor ministry guy, and she said, I knew I was getting into the ministry, but I didn't understand I was getting into the hunting culture. And now she's cooking all sorts of wild dishes and a very big supporter of it. But so would you say it was a way of life for you?
It was, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it was kind of my identity.
Yeah.
Was kind of built into it, you know, growing up, and my the crowd that I ran around with were all hunters, you know, and so, yeah, it was part of my identity.
Was it part of, for you and your dad, did you find it to be kind of like a bridge in the relationship? Is it something that you guys could kind of go to help keep things moving along? Or
I had a pretty, really good relationship with my dad, and we did everything together. Mm. So he was more like on the best friend kind of line. So we did a lot of stuff together, and it wasn't just hunting, but hunting was part of it. You know? And so I don't know if it would bridge anything, but it was definitely part of what
we did. It was part of the fun. Yeah. Well, so you could probably remember your first squirrel or your first rabbit or your first goose.
Dove I shot out of a tree, you know, with a 20 gauge, which I still shoot the same 20 gauge.
Yeah. Isn't that cool? Years.
Yeah. And guns are kind of sentimental to me. That I don't, for me, it's about, it's about the history or what the story is behind the gun. And not so much whether I'm shooting a 410 or a 12 gauge or whatever. It's the history that's associated with that for me.
Yeah, and for, you know, we were talking about it a couple of weeks ago with Randy or whatever, and I was just saying, you know, what do you shoot? And, you know, he mentioned different shot size and different guns. And then I said, you know, I mean, I've got a really nice over and under that I like and a 20 gauge, but I actually am far more accurate, do a better job, I'm more comfortable with a 12-gauge 870 and super light shot. Yeah. And the reason why is I grew up duck hunting, and that was the gun I've been shooting for 20 years, you know.
Right.
So it's like, and what Randy's point was really good was, well, then it's good to shoot with a gun you're successful with for the species and for yourself, you know. Like,
oh, absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, I had that. I got that. I have a 20-gauge pump, 870, that I've had since I was 10 years old, and I'm sure my dad bought that used. I'm 58 now.
Mm.
So that gun's shot, you know, a lot of shells through it, and I've never had any problems with it. Great gun. But I did go to an over-under that I had a friend that had raised, he had trained dogs and been run trials and stuff for 74 years.
Holy moly.
And he just got out of it. And his name was Ray Tafor, and he's 90 years old right now.
Okay.
And so he gave me his Orion, a Weatherby Orion
over
under.
Wow.
And so I've been shooting that. And biggest reason, though, is because I can catch my shells, right? That's, with an over and under, you pop and you pull them out.
Yeah, I don't.
With a pump,
yeah.
You know, and
no, I get it.
You're searching for
shells.
I don't
like it. I agree.
Kind of
and you feel guilty. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, like,
and you can't find them all.
No.
As much as you search, you're like, I just can't do it.
Yeah,
so.
Especially if you're on a good covey.
Right.
That's the bummer. So growing up, hunting was a way of life for you, and you're native to Arizona?
Pretty much, yeah. I was born in Silver City.
Okay.
And then we moved to Tucson when I was young, and my dad was the district ranger on the Coronado National Forest.
Oh, wow. So you grew up running around that country.
Yeah, we grew up a lot, just in the desert. And then in the summers, we'd spend time up in a ranger's cabin on Mount Lemmon. So it was just a really good, really good place to grow up. You know?
There's a secret with a lot of those cabins, those Forest Service cabins. When I first got to Arizona, I went to recreation.gov and I found out all the cabins and started renting them out and taking my family all around the state. And we're staying in some of the coolest places in the state.
That's a secret.
It's a secret. It's a secret.
It's like giving somebody your honey hole.
Well, what? I'm telling you, recreation. Yeah.
It's cool.
It's a public service, yeah. And it's not going to hurt the species of anything, really.
It might hurt my personal ability to get into one of the cabins. So, I'm just kidding.
Every time I go to one and I'm staying at one and somebody says to me, "What? You can rent those things?"
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, yeah, man, you just.
It's pretty neat.
Read the sign.
It's pretty neat.
The
one we stayed in as a kid is now part of that system.
Mm-hmm. I bet.
Up in Mount Lemmon. It's a really neat place. So.
I think I know which one you're talking about. I think I took my dad there. So.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big family value for ours is just, a family and having fun and in the outdoors and. I've seen some of your work that you've done in Arizona Game and Fish, and I think I watched a video one time of you doing a burrow hunt or something like that. You went on no, you weren't on a burrow hunt. You were hunting for quail in the backcountry off of like horseback or
with burrow. Llamas. With llamas.
Okay.
Yeah, we packed in with llamas and went in on the Arizona Trail, and we were chasing merns. And there was a big group of us in there, and it was a lot of fun.
It was a cool video to watch.
But we didn't harvest a lot. It was I don't remember how many years ago that was, 2 or 3.
Was that on YouTube that it was on, or
it was a Quail Forever production? So I'm guessing it was on YouTube.
I think we got somebody's here.
But it was just a really cool opportunity to get in there, and it was with a guy. Arizona Trail Llamas, I think, is the guy that had the llamas. And I used to have llamas myself.
Yeah.
But anyway, but there was a bunch of us in there, and we hunted hard, but it was that time of year, first part of the year, and the scenting conditions weren't all that great. And so you're kind of stuck in an area. Once you do something like that, it's not like you can just jump in the car and go somewhere.
Yeah.
You kind of have to hunt that area out.
Yeah, you're kind of dedicated,
right? And so, we didn't run into that many birds. I think we only saw like 3 or 4 coveys of birds after 2 days or a full day of hunting, an afternoon and a morning.
But it was an experience.
It was unbelievable experience. Yeah. And it was fun. The people we were with were great. And then after that, we bailed and walked back to the truck and went and tried a different area. And it was really fun.
That's so cool. Alan just walked
Alan,
into the back.
How are you?
Yeah, we had Alan come in, and one of Wade's buddies and a friend of mine as well came in and jumped in to hang out on the back porch. Alan, make yourself comfortable.
Okay.
Whatever you need. So.
Good. Thanks.
So I guess on some of the just discussion of one question came in, it's just kind of like what is one of your favorite species to hunt and why?
So on the gambles, quail by far. And for me, it's just the distribution of gambles. And I like hunting in areas where there's not a lot of people.
Yeah.
And gambles, quail gives me an opportunity to get out. I won't run into people. I'll go out 10 times and never see another bird hunter out there. And the distribution is good. And you can you can travel pretty much all the state and find gambles, and south of the Mogollon Rim.
Yeah.
And there's some populations north of the Mogollon Rim, too, which is kind of interesting. But
yeah, I think they're my favorite bird now. I mean, I had to go chase merns and go chase some scalies, but I think gambles are my favorite, too. And one of the reasons why is Dan Priest was telling me it's his favorite bird, too, to hunt. He was saying, gambles are a ton of fun because they can get up to some pretty decent-sized coveys.
Right.
And then if you spread them out in thick enough cover, they're going to hold great.
And they're a challenge for the dogs, and that's what I love watching the dogs try and figure out what's going on with them, And we had some fabulous hunts, just like what you're talking about, where the birds were just holding tight. And we've had areas that are times that we couldn't get them pinned down.
Yeah.
They just ran and ran and ran, and then they'd fly out 150 yards away. But I really enjoy gambles and the biggest part of that is just watching the dogs try and figure them out because they're going to run out from underneath the dog. The dog's got to know how much space to give them before you push them, And it's pretty unique. And I think, I'm not talking bad about merns because merns are really a cool and unique bird, but about any pointer can hunt merns quail, in a cubby, cubby situation, right? Because they hold tight. They don't tempt the dogs to bust them for the most part. They pretty much hold tight, and as long as the dog's stands its ground. They're not moving, you know. And that doesn't really challenge a dog.
It's not
steadiness.
Quite the challenge for it, for gamblers.
But I enjoy it. I enjoy it.
And absolutely.
Big numbers is another. I mean, when you're, I saw a couple cubbies this year that were, 40 plus birds, easy, mm-hmm. And it was just really a good year. It was a good year this year.
Yeah, I don't think the guys down south saw those numbers though.
No,
the
they
gambles
didn't.
Gambles quail. Because I kept talking to some of those guys down there. I'm like, man, I mean, it's very normal for me to see a covey of 20, 30, even 40 birds.
Yeah.
I mean, there's places that I've gotten into and they're not really worth hunting, but I mean, I think I could go probably, I don't know, today, because now there are a lot of them are pairing up and stuff.
Right.
But during season, I could take you out there and I'd say we might bump into 100 birds in a covey.
Yeah.
And you'd look at it and go, yeah, well, there's no way we're going to be able to hunt those. just because of the terrain,
right,
it's like they're there.
Well, to get kind of an idea, so this year was the first year that I've been hunting birds, like I told you, 40 plus years for gambles, right? This was the first year I've ever limited on desert birds, and I did it 4 times.
Wow.
That's because the numbers were good and because I was retired,
mm-hmm.
so I wasn't just going out for 2 or 3 hours.
Well,
I was hunting 5 or 6 hours a day,
Yeah.
So which made a huge difference in that.
Yeah.
And then, with Mearns numbers being where there is, I only went out Mearns, I think, 3 times. I think I harvested 15 birds all season.
Yeah.
I mean, and couple walks where I wasn't seeing any birds,
mm-hmm.
But then you'd
mm-hmm.
come into a pocket where there was, a full covey, mm-hmm. 10 to 12 birds,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, it was a interesting year this year. And scalies that I hunted down south, I didn't see the numbers that I'd seen in the past, at least where I was hunting.
Right.
And I know other people were doing pretty well, but
yeah.
just in the areas I were, the numbers weren't up from last year on scale quail.
Yeah. And it's, right now most people are saying that it's some kind of El Nino weather pattern of sorts where it's going to be likely a wet winter, dry summer kind of thing. Another hard hit for the Mearns and then the desert quail perhaps too a little bit. So,
yeah, you very seldom, in Arizona that I can remember where you have good winter rains, good summer rains, good winter rains. You usually only get one or the other. You usually get good winter rains or you get good summer rains. Get both.
And the heydays that many of you guys talk about would be the times when it was winter and summer.
No, we had really good winter rains. If you look at the weather pattern in the 80s, we had 7 out of 9 years where we had really wet winters. And so that's what really drove those bird numbers up. And also deer numbers were way up. Antelope numbers were way up. And it was all focused around that winter rain.
And correct me if I'm wrong, though, back in the 80s, there wasn't near the interest in Mearns quail.
So I didn't hunt Mearns quail until in the 90s because I was graduated from the university at U of A in 91.
Okay.
And so I was hunting them kind of in that late 80s, mm-hmm. early 90s was the first time I ever hunted them. And no, there wasn't near the number of people that mm-hmm. are out there now.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still a dedicated few that hunted them pretty hard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into, I guess I want to come back to that idea of just, pressure on Mearns and all that kind of conversation and whatnot. But let's talk a little bit about, just tell us about your time with Arizona Game and Fish.
Yeah, so I was with the department for 30 years. I enjoyed 98% of it. It was a really good career to be in,
mm-hmm.
and I bounced around quite a bit. I worked in the hatcheries for 10 years, about 10 years of that 30 years, and then the majority of it was with the landowner relations program, where I was out working with ranchers and landowners building habitat projects, whether through water or brush management, kind of restoring grasslands or improving browse cover for deer and other wildlife.
Okay.
And that was that was the most rewarding part of that job is I always love to see the tangible,
seeing some habitat
see it get
transform.
Done, where you can be out there in 1 week and then 2 weeks later, it's different, and you can see the impact almost immediately. You start seeing deer moving into that country and, You know, it's just, it's pretty amazing to see the transformation.
Yeah.
And it happens pretty quick, you know, and especially if you, the rain time, if the timing of the rain works out well, it's just unbelievable how quick
you find that,
most
of the ranchers were pretty easy to work with, like as far as improving their properties. And,
you know, it's a benefit to both of us, right? And that's how I always sold it as an employee was, you know, this is a mutually beneficial projects. You know, we're either adding water, increasing water for livestock and wildlife, or we're improving habitat for wildlife and livestock. So it was a pretty much a win-win, you know, as far as working with ranchers. And ranchers are like hunters, you know, 95% of them are great, 5% are crap.
You know,
that's just how it is. That's just the, you know, how things work, you know. So, but it was a real rewarding job. I was actually the small game program manager for 3 years with the department, and I was commuting from Cottonwood down to Phoenix every day. And
this location up here, by Carefree,
In Carefree, it's
off 74,
And so that was just, it wasn't very conducive to family life, you know, when you're leaving at dark and you're getting back in the dark. And so I went back to doing the land. So I took a pay cut and went back into doing the landowner relations program stuff.
Because you valued that more.
Yeah. It was better for family. It was better for my sanity. A lot less stress. You know, I wasn't in the policy and process side of things as much. You know, and that's always a tough place to be, because you're never going to make anybody happy. You try and do the right thing for the species you're in charge of. And biologists with the department, that's their goal. That's really what they want to do, is do what's right for wildlife. And, you know, you get a lot of influence outside that saying, oh, we're doing it for the money, we're doing it for, that's not the case. Yeah. There's the biologists for the department don't get paid a whole lot.
Yeah.
They make a living. And
like that book right there, you know, Randy wrote that book, and I'm like, boy, does that help you out in your retirement? He's like, oh no.
Right.
That goes to Game and Fish.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh man.
Well, and Randy got into it probably for the same reason
passion.
I did, right? It's a passion that you have, and I've had it since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And what better place to spend your life in a career
that you love?
That you love, yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, everything's work. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
When you got to be there, it's work.
Right.
But might as well be doing something,
you enjoy,
that you're passionate about, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. So I guess, on the Arizona Game and Fish stuff, I mean, how do you feel like things are going now in regards to some of the, I guess, the questions have come around this whole, you know, MERN season, shortening the season, changing the season. There was some open forum dialogue recently, I think.
Yeah, you know, I missed all that stuff, but, you know, I'm not a department employee anymore. So, you know, I can kind of talk about, you know, a little bit on how that's typically dealt with, but that doesn't mean much, right?
Right.
I mean, you've got different people in charge, different commissioners, and so that it changes the dynamics of everything and decisions that are made. But overall, you know, a lot of these, one thing, shortening the season makes absolutely no sense to me. And I'll just say that from a personal aspect, right? Because you still have the same demand. All you're doing is slamming more
compressing
people into a smaller time frame.
So you're thinking that biologically it's not going to really have any kind of impact?
Biologically, my personal feeling is that quail numbers drive hunters. Hunters do not drive quail numbers. And that you see that with Gamble's quail hunting. You've seen that with MERNs. Last year the numbers were extremely good for MERNs, and there were a lot of people in the field.
The numbers were extremely good for MERNs?
Last year.
Based on wing stuff, counts?
Based on being in the field.
Yeah.
And right. I didn't see what the wing data was.
Yeah.
I'm not talking this year.
Right.
The year
prior
year.
Yeah.
And numbers were probably, the only better year I remember was like in the mid-90s somewhere.
Okay.
There were really high numbers of MERNs then too.
Okay.
And
I don't recall that. I remember it was a pretty good Gamble season, but I'm not chasing a lot of MERNs at all.
Yeah, so, yeah, last year was really good for MERNs. Yeah. I mean, covey numbers were up. They were harvest, I'm sure, was up. I wasn't privy to the wing barrels information. I didn't chase that down. But that's one tool that, you know, can a lot of bird hunters think they're conservationists, but they don't take the time to drop their wings in the wing barrel. They don't take their time to fill out
the survey information. Yeah.
And it doesn't take that long. I keep a log all year long, and so I look forward to putting all that stuff down on a paper, you know, for the question.
Well, that's good.
But that's kind of a duty in my mind that hunters have, right? You've got to be conservative. There's no reason you can't drop wings in the wing barrel. Yeah. You know, and that's the
unless there's not a wing barrel around.
Yeah, but they're pretty much covered. Anything down south, other than the Chiricahuas.
Yeah, because I don't think I've seen a single wing barrel out where I hunt.
So I would bet you've driven right by them.
Well, you're probably right. You're probably right. But
and I've talked to a lot of people that say, well, not a lot. I've talked to the few people that I have talked to that said they're not doing it. Well, I don't want to let people know where I hunt. You know, I don't want people to know where I'm successful.
Arizona Game and Fish isn't publicizing.
No, not for the most part. I mean, there are few people, but they're not privy to that data that are really likely to say, go hunt here, go hunt here. Now, and that's bad.
And those
practice.
Numbers could be so skewed because you could have a particular group of hunters that, like, if you go down south, to me, I've seen those wing barrels very clearly.
Those are the ones I'm talking about.
Yeah, down south, I've seen all those.
Yeah.
I'm talking about further in the north central.
We don't have any. We don't have any.
Okay, that's what I was talking about.
Mearns is the only thing that we have wing barrels set out.
Yeah. That's what I was saying.
And those numbers, it's not the best avenue to gain data.
Yeah, but it's a point.
It's a point, and it gives you trend information, right, from year to year on what's going on. Obviously, it's going to be an overestimation because people that don't kill any birds don't put no bird wings in the wing barrel.
Yeah.
You know what
I
mean?
Well, another thing that, this is another just random question. It's not random, but it's correlated a little bit. But Randy had kind of come to me with the idea of doing, I think what do we call it, Alan? It was like basically you're driving a road early in the morning and you're seeing birds cross the road and you're doing counts based on just off the road. They call them historical survey routes.
Call counts,
Not call counts, but survey routes.
Like
you're not listening to any calls. You're just counting old survey routes Arizona Game and Fish had back in the 50s, 60s, or something like that. And then we've tried to slowly revive some of those routes, and they're broken up now, you know.
Yeah. So when I was a small game program, that was one of my major pushes, was to reestablish a lot of those, the gamble quail routes.
Yeah, it'd be
the call counts. And we had historical routes that could be redone year after year. And we did reestablish two in Region 3, and we started two, Region 3 beating up by Kingman. And then the area in Region 6 and Region 3, that Bloody Basin mid-central stuff.
Yeah.
We put in, there's a route there now. And then the historic routes that have been run since, I think, the 50s.
Yeah, we have a documentation of those routes. I think I gave them one to you, Alan. Yeah.
So, and that's really good information, because that definitely, the higher the call counts, the higher the harvest has been based on the questionnaires.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a good indicator of where we're at as far as number goes. And for me, it was, as a small game program manager, was the ability, it gave me the ability to just communicate with the groups that were putting out forecasts, right? Mm-hmm. Where you had some type of data that you could relate to them. Say, our call counts are up 70% or they're down 20%. It wasn't, because before that, all you're doing is getting on the phone or answering those questions. Say, well, our rain was good. We think we'll have good bird numbers, you know? And so this gave some quantitative measure to be able to kind of predict which parts of the state were going to do better. So you had the ability to kind of guide people where the better pressure or the more birds were at.
Right.
So you weren't hitting the places where their low numbers were at, you know?
And definitely rain has got to be a factor.
It is the biggest factor. I mean, we've had a lot of discussion on what type of habitat work you can do for gamble's quail. I don't know what you do for gamble's quail.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about where they've evolved in the Sonoran Desert,
what a broad geographical range that they're covering.
And what do you do? I mean, they basically have been here without water on the landscape for hundreds, thousands of years, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so what do you do to improve that habitat? Now, scale quail, there's some stuff you can do habitat-wise with scale quail, and there's stuff you can do habitat-wise for Mearns quail. But gambles, I just was never knew what to do with that, you know, and how to address those mm-hmm. things. But
mm-hmm. Well, on so jumping into, I guess, a little bit about some of the kind of the questions that have come in, or what are your thoughts on, I guess this, we'll jump into that research that I think that you had provided or whatever. It's a bit dated. It's some effects of human activity and habitat conditions on Mearns quail populations, August 2000. What were some of the highlights that you found in there?
So
that would be pertinent to today's conversation.
So interesting enough that that whole research study that was done was based on a lot of the same concerns that people have today.
Yeah.
You know, overhunting. Overhunting in certain areas.
Yeah.
Got it. Number, you know, just pressure from out non-residents, which was in here as well.
Yeah.
The increase in technology, improving harvest, you know, like dog collars, that type of stuff. So the same exact concerns were there when this study was done. And at the time, that's when I think the limit went from 15 to 8.
Mm-hmm.
In 96, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so this study was basically looking at that and see what the impact was to the mm-hmm. harvest by doing that. And it showed that there was no impact to harvest.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't increase harvest, didn't reduce harvest. Mm-hmm. Harvest was basically the same. And that was done through questionnaires, targeted questionnaires, and wing barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting that the same questions are coming up.
Yeah,
you know, you're
absolutely.
Looking 23, 24 years later, and absolutely. Everybody's trying to answer the exact same question. Well, you know, my personal feeling on that is you can't hurt the population of Mearns by hunting them. You can hurt individual coveys by hunting them, like knocking out certain, like you've got an isolated habitat piece where you're not going to have Mearns coming in from adjacent habitats to fill those niches when they get shot out. You can have an impact on that local population, but as a population as a whole, it'd be pretty tough to really impact them with hunters.
Yeah, I mean, outside of normal circumstances, like I mean, some bizarre amount of hunters putting pressure on entire regions.
You know, and there's some unknowns to that weren't here, you know, 24 years ago, right? The social media aspect and information that's out there to guide hunters into where to go.
Yeah.
Onyx, mapping stuff, that's definitely a part of it. Advantage, right?
Yeah.
And so there are some of those questions that could be looked at again, right?
I mean, because you're talking about even in 2000, there was not at all the connectivity that's going on today.
Yeah, you had to get on the ground and find stuff, right?
I mean, like Onyx, I don't know when it launched, but that's a game changer.
Oh, huge game changer, right? You look at it and you say, "Okay, that looks like pretty good habitat there.
Yeah.
Let's go in there. There's a road right there.
Hey, let me send this pin over to so-and-so.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So, but, you know, this is a really interesting look at the questions that are currently with us right now with Mearns quail, you know?
Yeah. I think one of the things that stood out to me was that grazing didn't have quite the impact I thought it would have. I mean, I did go down several times to southern Arizona, and I hunted some spots that I thought would be pretty good, and it looked overgrazed.
Right.
You know, but my definition of overgrazed and the bird's definition are sometimes different, because I found birds, and what I would say were overgrazed, but they were there.
Right. So, the nice thing about these scientific reports and the way they're done, the research is they have control and non-control areas, right? And I mean, you're familiar with the science and how things are put together, you know. And on the grazing aspect of it, so grazing disturbance, just put it that way, disturbance is a key producer of forbs that Mearns quail rely on. So when you have areas that are grazed, you're going to get more of a flush of forbs and oxalis and that type of stuff, which support insects and the other type. So, But the other part of that is you have to have enough hiding cover for merns.
Absolutely.
So you have to have that really tight mix between disturbance and hiding cover. And so that's the challenge, but at least that's something you can manipulate, right, as far as grazing goes. And there's a lot of really cool stuff that they're doing in Montana where they're doing virtual fencing, where there's not even barbed wire fencing on the land. They just have big towers set up with, like, electronic dog fences. We kind of analogous to that
for the cattle,
livestock. Okay. So you don't even have fences, and you can move those around at any set time.
And that's cool.
Oh, it's amazing.
And the cattle are responding.
Yes. Yeah.
That's
and so
good.
It's one of those new things. It's the
better than barbed wire.
Better than barbed wire.
Ripping dogs up
and you can move cows around a little easier. The rancher doesn't have to have as much on the ground hands on moving fences.
It's probably a lot less expensive install too.
I don't know, but it's pretty interesting stuff. So there's some potential moving forward to where we can start working on the habitat issues without really impacting the multiple use that the Forest Service is required to do. And that's always a big thing. But ranchers want good habitat.
Yeah.
Their cows get fatter on good habitat, right?
Right.
And so there's a lot
more. They just get frustrated when you leave the gate open.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of frustrations,
you
right?
Know,
there's
but,
people.
And that's the frustrating part about it is, I mean, I was out, I won't name where, but I was out there in the backcountry, and on, I want to say it was either state land, but, there was, you know, ranchers that were running cattle on it, and the guy got super mad I was there because I was near a pond, and he, you know, and I was doing some dog training with a Blanks pistol,
right,
and retrieving,
right
because it's hot and I didn't want my dog and rattlesnakes, and my bird dogs, I can have them run in the water just for exercise and
right,
retrieving. And guy comes up and he's pretty mad and hot and tells me, get out of here, you're breaking the law. And I'm like, oh, which law? And he said, trespassing. I was like, this is state land.
Right.
Because Onyx told me so, you know. And right, then he says, well, you can't shoot near cattle or near a water hole. And I was like, well, it's a Blank pistol. I don't think I'm doing that one either. And then he's like, well, you're scaring all my cattle away, and they only come in once a day. And I said, you know what, buddy? I'll leave. I'll go ahead and pack up and go. And then, you know, funny thing is, I ran back into him later that day, and his boss was right beside him. He runs up to me and said, hey, I'm so sorry.
Right.
I jumped your gun. You know, I jumped you pretty hard. But I think that some of the guys are just worn out. That's what he told me. He said, we're just worn out by the yahoos that come through here and just tearing up, leaving gates open and all that stuff.
So, I mean, it's pretty tough. I mean, when they're trying to make their livelihood out there, granted it's public land, but I mean, it's public land and they're paying for the right to use it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's pretty important that we kind of build a relationship with them and just be, you know, try and do what's right. And most hunters do. So
yeah.
Most hunters are very, like, respectful of what's going on.
Yeah. One of the things I was pretty encouraged by was I came up onto one location, and you could advise listeners in on how to handle this situation. If I handled it differently, maybe I'd learn more. But I pulled up onto a property, and it basically was all locked up. And I'm like, according to my data, this is public land. I should be able to hunt here. And there was a number that said call if this gate's locked or something like that.
Right.
So I don't know. Is that a kind of a common thing from time to time where it's like, I don't know if it was, and this is jumping into probably another department, like state land stuff and BLM and.
So, yeah,
but they told me on the phone, no, you should be able to hunt there.
Right.
Just go ahead and hunt there.
Right.
And if you get trouble, just call us back. And I was like, thank you very much. I think I will.
Yeah. So state land is open to hunters in the act of hunting with a license.
Yeah.
Right. So,
and they put these fancy words on there to scare you off.
Yeah.
You have to have a permit.
A permit, right.
And your permit is your hunting license.
Right. But there's also, you know, it takes money to run the state land department, right? And there's a recreational fee. So if people are out hiking or stuff, they should go buy the annual fee. It's like 15 bucks a year, right? I mean, it's not much for you, not much for me. And it gives us the ability to do that. Flip side of that is there's no enforcement of that from state land. Mm-hmm. So it's really tough, you know, for anybody.
They're not going to enforce it.
They're not going to enforce it, right? And so, but I mean, as a user of the resource, $15 a year or whatever it is to go out on state land without having, you know, then you don't even need a license, right? If you want to go walk your dog, you can go walk your dog on state land.
So you can just buy, I'm not even aware of this.
Yeah,
so
it's a recreational permit for state land.
For state land in Arizona.
In Arizona.
And $15.
I think it's $15.
Okay, something like that.
It's really cheap. You can get them online through the state land department.
Oh my goodness.
And it, yeah, nobody knows about it, but that gives you the same right as your hunting license gives you to go out there and recreate.
But if I have a hunting license, then I'm good to go anywhere.
And you're hunting, in the act of hunting.
Oh, you have to be in the act of hunting.
Yes.
But I always have guns in my truck. And,
right.
Yeah, and I'm
absolutely
always, could be hunting
rabbits. Rabbits are open. Yeah, so.
It's a, yeah, okay. I get it.
Yeah. And so for me, I buy a state land permit.
Yeah.
Recreational permit. You know, I didn't this year yet.
Yeah.
But, it's something that's good to do. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it doesn't cost you much. You know? And I'm taking my dogs out walking out on state land where I live. So.
Yeah. I like going real far where no one else goes.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I found out once I was building out my truck, I was overlanding.
Right.
And I didn't know that was something, and I figured it out. I was like, oh, well, I'm an overlander. I was like, that's right. Too cool. Well, I guess talk to us a little bit about, I guess, some of the Mearns, again, discussion. We haven't talked about that in our previous podcasts as much, but I'll try to take some of these questions that had come in. And so one from, let's go with Dan Priest, a friend of mine, a founder of Q5, founder of Arizona Outdoor Adventures, and actually founder of Arizona Quail Today,
right.
Who said, Ryan, you should take this and run with it. And so I did. He had mentioned just so many, just curiosity about the Montezuma quail, the Mearns quail up in the White Mountains. What are your thoughts on that? Have you seen them yourself? What do you think the department, is there studies? Just talk about that.
Yeah, so I have hunted Montezuma's Mearns quail. And just for some clarification on the name, so Mearnsii is the subspecies. And if you look at just in this, it's Cretonyx Montezuma Mearnsii.
Wow.
So that's the quail that we hunt, the Mearns quail.
Yeah.
And so Mearnsii is the subspecies. Because there's always that controversy. It comes, are they Montezuma, are they Mearns, or are they both?
Yeah.
Right?
Wow. So,
anyway.
Yeah.
That sounds like
tomato
yeah,
to me.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. But you'll see it corrected in all kinds of stuff. And it's just
well, and I get corrected from time to time when I say Gamble's quail and I don't do E-L-S.
Oh, yeah.
Apostrophe S.
Apostrophe S.
You know, because it's named after William Gamble. And
not Mearns with the apostrophe at the end.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's a pet peeve of a lot of people,
you know.
And I have friends that correct me. And I'm like, hey, thanks for your feedback. I'll change that.
So anyway, as far as the White Mountains go, I have hunted Mearns quail in the White Mountains. And when I was the program manager, we pushed really hard to get some research established up there looking at the life cycle of those high elevation birds. And trying to determine, and it was a management question, right? And the question was, if these birds have a slightly different life cycle that's adjusted because of the cold climate, would it be possible that they're hatching earlier, and then they would be mature enough to hunt in, say, November, right?
Okay, so to potentially create a separate season?
A separate season for high mountains. It maybe would have been a shorter season. We don't know because we never did it. But so the big questions are, how do those birds survive up there?
That is the biggest question.
Right. How do they survive? do they move? You would think they'd have to, right? But there's a lot of those areas where they're at, where they would have to move a long, long way.
That's a lot of walking.
And, you know, my personal feeling, and not that I can prove any of this, is that they hang out in those rim rock areas, those heat sinks where you have the black lava rock. And I think that holds a lot of those birds in there. And then just rough, where I have found a lot of birds in that country is in real rocky terrain.
Is that along, any of that along the Black River?
Maybe.
Where those bighorn sheep might be?
Maybe.
Okay, maybe. There you go. I'm sorry. There you go. You want to try to keep it neutral. There we go.
Well, I was talking to a guy that was a high school teacher up in Sholo, And he's been hunting Merns up there for 20 plus years.
Boy, that'd be a guy. That's right. A pretty neat story.
Yeah. And so that, and so for me, I wanted to get his perspective on that as the program. So what do you think? And his biggest concern with that was if, you know, he said, if we were going to do that, we don't want to hunt him past one. Right. That was a big concern because he had some experience in an area where he'd gone in there and jumped like four coveys of birds and then had the snowstorm come in. And he went back there and he didn't.
Past 1 p.m.?
Past 1 p.m. in the afternoon.
That's what he was suggesting?
Yeah. Because he had the experience that
he scattered a bunch of birds.
Scattered a bunch of birds and they had a big snowstorm came in.
What a thought.
And it took 5 years for those birds, for him to find any more birds back in that area.
Boy, he felt guilty.
Yeah. And so he was the first one to admit it, right? Yeah. We all make mistakes, you know? And he was the one that, okay, this is what I've learned.
Wow.
You know, and so that's pretty honest feedback, and that's the kind of stuff that you kind of stand, okay, that makes sense, right, to me.
Yeah.
In that high elevation stuff, it makes sense.
Well, that's summit mentality. You're supposed to get up and down off the mountain by noon for big high elevation, high mountains.
But so, no, I think there's a need to at least understand those birds a little bit more, and as an agency, the department, I don't think they understand them. You know, it's just... For the department, the resources are fairly limited, so they have to be pretty selective of research projects that they take on, and it just never rose to the top.
But aren't they one of the most precious resources as far as the bird goes in Arizona?
They are. They were for me, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They were one of those things that just, they're a special bird, you know, and if we don't know something about it as a department, I think it should be our responsibility to figure it out.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, how do you manage a population if you don't know anything about them?
Yeah. And I think sheer logic shows on the, you know, as far as the numbers go, you're going to have far more gambles than you will merge, just geographically speaking.
Right.
More room, more habitat, more diverse adaptability, whatnot. Scaled quail right behind that. I mean, significantly, I guess, you know, gambles are such a high population of birds. And then your merns. Perhaps last, but the question I would have is what would you say then is the right approach for merns hunting in Arizona for the average listener?
For the average?
The average hunter.
As far as ethics?
Maybe ethics. You were saying, you know, like it's a precious resource. You know, there's a lot that we don't understand about those birds. There's still a lot to.
So I don't think there's a lot that we don't understand about those northern population birds. I think we have a really good idea on how the southern populations, you know, I think the department does.
Okay.
Just because we have done multiple studies. Some of it's outdated, but how much of the birds' behavior actually changed?
Mm-hmm.
People, maybe something that might be another question that's worth looking deeper into. But as far as the actual bird behavior, I think we pretty much understand that in southeastern Arizona.
And my guess would be is the response with Arizona Game and Fish would be something along the lines of, "Look, those birds are so spotty geographically in the northern region. It's gonna have zero impact if we change any kind of season dates for them." And then like. Geographically speaking, in those higher elevation areas.
Right.
Is that right?
What is the management implication? Right?
Yeah. And so currently it just applies to the regular standard season.
And you can hunt them statewide.
Yeah.
But
I don't think anybody's going in there slaying them.
No.
You know, I mean.
So that terrain that the one where I find birds in there, it's not terrain you want to go walk around in very much. I mean, it's pretty steep, rocky stuff is where I was finding them at.
And what's odd about that area, though, is I've been around there, during the summer, fishing, camping out there, been out to dance camps, Arizona Outdoor Adventures, and then I've been out there quite a bit, you know, over the years going snowboarding out there, Sunrise.
Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like been one of those areas out there, it's like one of the coldest spots in America. I could be wrong, but I think it hit as one of the coldest locations in America.
It may have, but
it was like it's one area, and I drove my car through there one day, and I bet I was negative. I don't know anybody listening, North Dakota, South Dakota. You're smoking a crack pipe, you know, but
It's cold, and there's a ton of snow.
Yeah.
And so those birds, you think perhaps are hiding up in the mountains?
Yeah, that would be
That would be my thought. Or another theory is they're hibernating.
I don't think they're not hibernating.
I don't think they are either.
No, they're hiding. They're hiding either in a heat sink, where they can get, or they're moving down in elevation. You know, they're dealing with it one way or another. But yeah, they're not hibernating. They're not going in a cave and hiding out.
So you don't think there's any more research on the docket for Game and Fish to go get those, to study those birds?
I don't know. I can't speak as a department employee at all, you know, as far as where that sets as a priority.
What would be, what would be, like, if there was an organization that could channel resources for funding, what would it take? You've probably done big research projects or been involved with something like that. What do you estimate?
I've done some research, but not to the scale that that something like that would take on. And the research I did when I was brand new with the department, so I don't have a research background. That's a totally kind of a different aspect.
Is it like you got to get a couple biologists and they're living out there?
You'd have to put some type of transmitters on the birds, to where you could follow them around.
And that takes legal process.
I don't think that process would be that, but it's what's the bang for your buck, right? Like, what information are you going to gain by spending this kind of money? And by money, it's like we were talking about, it's having technicians. You'd probably need 4 people in the field over time, monitoring where those birds are, being able to map them, and then some type of statistical reference that validates where they're. Oh, it's absolutely good.
That'd be
good,
really cool if Quail Forever or even Arizona Quail Today could put together a grant or some kind of project.
No, I mean, it would be neat.
That'd be historical evidence or historical information.
Yeah, and you know, it is management. It's a need for management, right? You're trying to manage a bird at its very, very, very northern extent of their range. So you would think over time
of the United States,
of the historic of Mearns quail. We're kind of at the northern edge of their distribution, right?
Right.
And so,
at least in you would this think part of the
over
world.
Time that there was a lot of fluctuation anyway, based on climate, right? You've got climates changed, birds are going to move and flow. Same with javelina is another one, right? Javelina didn't used to be up north, and now they're up in the White Mountains. You know, so there's those animals. When you're on the fringe, you're going to expand and retract significantly, based on climate, you know, and what's going on. In my opinion, it would open up a little bit more opportunity if you could figure out what their life cycle was exactly, and you could add some additional opportunity to hunt Mearns quail in the White Mountains, right? If you could do it from November to the first part, maybe even a 2-week season, at least that could pull some of the pressure off of southern Arizona. You know, maybe people from the White Mountains would just hunt those 2 months and they'd be done. Yeah. You know what I mean? It has the potential to have some increase some opportunity for hunting in Arizona.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Boy, that's cool. I don't know what it would take to do that, but I'd be curious. I'll bring it up with Quail Forever. I'm sure you probably have. You ever had the conversation with those guys?
Yeah, we have.
What do they say?
They're supportive of it, you'd have to have. So, like I said, I'm not a research biologist.
Right.
So number one, you'd have to have somebody that had the interest in being a research that is a research biologist to design the study to answer the questions exactly what you want to get out of that.
I wonder if Game and Fish would, if the money was raised. And that's
they may.
If the money was raised, they'd donate some biologists to it.
If you could fund a position, then that could be a potential. You know,
Who should I talk to? Not that I'm making any promises. I'm just curious. Like,
right? I mean, you could always bring it up to the program manager that's there. Larissa Harding is.
Oh, I've met her. Yeah.
So she's the small game program manager now.
Okay. Well, I'll have her on hopefully over the backyard here. Yeah, back porch.
She, I enjoy. She's working hard, trying to do the right thing.
I was with her. I think on one of her first quail hunts.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was pretty cool. So,
yeah.
Yeah, she's a neat gal. Okay, so more on Mearns quail. This is going to be kind of a big highlight for Mearns quail, and then we'll wrap it off with dogs.
Okay.
Poodle pointers.
All right.
Yeah. So, yeah, curious to hear about that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I need to disclose. I'm not a Mearns expert by any means.
Oh, I know.
You know, I mean, I've started hunting them, and most of my knowledge is based on reading technical supports and being or technical reports and being in the field. So I'm not. It's not like I'm an expert in Mearns quail by any means. You know, I just appreciate them as a species and enjoy chasing them around with dogs.
Yeah. Well. I guess, let me see if I can find just some more of these questions here. Let's see. What would you say for, as far as, you know, some of the questions I think was, you know, is, in your opinion, is Arizona Game and Fish, you know, do you think that they're going to change the Mearns seasons, the limits, and kind of... or, you know, try to uphold to kind of a science-based approach. How are they going to manage this added pressure on Mearns quail? And everybody notices there's an extra pressure on Mearns quail. You don't. You can be a beginner hunter and go, whoa, there's a lot of trucks in the down here, you know.
So they're, you know, these are always really tough questions because there's the social side of things and then there's the biological side of things, right? And those are two separate things. But as far as how the department is going to, so how that typically works with the department is the program leads, like for the small game program, would provide information, the science involved with what's going on to the commission.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the commission will make those final decisions. It's up to them whether they make those decisions based on the data that's provided to them, or if they base those decisions more on the social realm of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the department provides data, and they definitely speak their mind and are allowed to speak their minds on the data that they have.
Mm-hmm.
But then it is the commission's privilege to instate those changes in regulations, right? So the commissions are the one that's making those decisions. Now, it's up to them whether they want to use the data or if they think that the more driving force is the social side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in my opinion, is what's driving a lot of the discussion right now is the social side of things.
Mm-hmm.
The biological side of things is not driving those discussions because there's been enough research that's been put out that defines that hunter pressure does not impact bird numbers as a whole population, right?
Well, and I mean, I just did the hunter's education with my daughter for elk hunting, and it talked about what are the most crucial factors that limit game populations worldwide is how they kind of phrased it.
Right.
And number one, it was actually just urbanization.
Right.
Like,
absolutely.
So it's like, and then everybody thinks it's, oh, hunters.
Right.
But it's actually, hunters was the lowest on the category for impacting any kind of species.
Right.
So urbanization, climate, you know, another one was, you know, that I thought was a big one was the grazing.
Right.
But.
So, and habitat, you get to the habitat's the core. And a lot of times you can't predict what's going to happen with the weather, or you know you can't. So what you try and do as a biologist is you set the what we used to call setting the plate, right, or setting the table. You go out and you try and provide the best habitat you possibly can. So when you get the precipitation events that are positive, that you're going to see that influx of the population.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see that increased population. So that's what you try and manage for is those ideal habitat states. So Game and Fish can't dictate what the Forest Service does, right? We manage the wildlife. We don't manage the habitat, which puts us in a really sticky, as a biologist.
But you can advise the ranchers.
We can recommend things. We can get we can work with the ranchers, we can work with the Forest Service on habitat projects, and when I was with the department, we stayed out of we made recommendations on grazing, but we are not range managers, and we were told that a number of times. So we don't get involved in range management decisions. Mm-hmm. We definitely voice our opinion on what would make it better.
I'm just asking the question. I don't know. You know, is it a big cash cow for all the ranchers and everybody to lease property from National Forest, state land, BLM, all that kind of stuff?
So I can tell you that they lease that land at a very minimal or at a low rate.
So it's not like it costs the ranchers a ton of money to do that kind of stuff. It's not like they're raking in tons of dough to do it.
No, and I believe the ranchers are paying $1.35 per AUM, which is an animal unit month.
So $1.35.
Whatever that was. So if you've got an allotment that says you can run 300 cows, you multiply that times 135, right? And that's what the Forest Service is getting for the management for grazing that land.
And then money, but there's an economy all around.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, like an industry. Right. So, you know, like you get ski resorts that depend on, you know, the White Mountains is subsidizing the Sunrise ski resort to ensure that Pine Top's got people coming in.
Right. And that's the other size of both quail hunting. You know, you look at quail hunting down in southern Arizona, at Patagonia, their economy is pretty much built on.
Right. You don't get all those breweries and all those cool spots without the bird hunters, in my opinion.
Right.
Those are there because the bird hunters came in.
Right. And that's the same thing around the ranching community, right? They may get a lease rate, but they're also bringing, you know, they're employing people to do it, to run cows with them. They're not doing it by themselves usually. You know, they're spending their money locally. They're producing meat. So there's a lot more to it than just that $1.35. They're maintaining infrastructure. You know, they should be maintaining all the waters. You shouldn't, in my opinion, you shouldn't see a water that's empty just because the cows aren't there.
Yeah.
Right. It's a multiple use. So in my mind, they're providing it for their livestock. They need to be providing it for wildlife either, because they are getting a reduced rate to lease that land.
Yeah. So in your mind, what is the greatest threat for Emerns in Arizona?
So the biggest threat is just the climate change.
So how the...
Or seasonal precipitation change, right? If we have multiple El Nino years,
right,
where we have, say, 10, right? If you had 10 really wet winters and really dry summers, that's the biggest threat.
Are those birds going to just kind of move down south further towards they'll
move into a little tighter niches, right, where you've got more north. This is my thought.
Yeah,
they would move into those real shady areas where you've got more canopy cover,
more moisture
on the ground where they can dig for their tubers and the things that they eat.
Yeah,
you know, so they would have to shift to make that work. So that's, to me, that's the biggest threat to local populations. Hunting pressure can be a threat, and I'm not minimizing that at all.
Right.
But it's not. People have to understand
the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, if you're looking at the grand scheme of things, you've got a fairly reduced habitat for Emerns as it is, right? If it's very healthy, you've got a very small geographic area, right? But you get people that key in on certain spots within that, they're gonna do some damage to those localized populations, you know. And so to me, you know, as a hunter, ethics is what you have to teach, and how to approach a covey of birds, right? You get in those canyons and if you jump a full covey of birds, 12 birds, and you know how that you'll get, usually you get a flush and then you'll get another flush, right?
Right.
And so for me, if I'm in question, if it's not a big flush and I know right away I can shoot, then I wait, because you can always, if you get a late flush, you can shoot on the late flush, right? Yeah. If you get three birds that come up, you're like, oh, and then another five come up, well, you can take one of the five, you know? And the other opportunity is to always follow up on singles. If you don't kill one out, this is how I hunt. If I come up on a bird and I jump a covey of birds and I'm not sure, and I watch them fly up on the hill and I didn't shoot any, I'll go chase singles just to give my dog some work. And and I don't care what anybody says. People like to kill birds, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you just do it for the dog, why even bring a gun?
Right.
if all you want to do is watch the dog run, why bring a gun?
Yeah,
you
know? Absolutely.
So there's a little bit to that that people kind of shy away from, right?
Yeah.
I like to kill birds, and they taste good, you know? So anyway, so I know that's a really controversial issue, and so that's all I can speak about is my personal experience and my feelings and what I know. And I've hunted a lot of areas where I've hunted them year after year that get hammered.
Yeah.
A lot of people come in there, but they have enough habitat. This is my feeling that the habitat is so good adjacent to that area and the escape cover is so good that those birds in good years, they filter right back in. So every year you can walk the same canyon and kill them. Now, this year I went to an area that I've hunted for 20 years and walked the same loop I've hunted years, and I did not find a covey of birds. And I did that three times.
They probably got hammered out.
And they got hammered out. And I was there the year before, and there were nine trucks in that area. You know, so they, somehow, some way,
those are the spots I avoid now.
Right.
You know, it just saddens me to see that because it's, you know, I'll go out, and I, you know, I told the story earlier, but I went out and hunted for the Grand Slam, and when I got into Mearns Pocket, there wasn't a lot, you know, in some of those areas like that, where there's a Grand Slam, it's like there's not a lot of any of them almost, you know. It's like you're just hunting a very unique spot.
Yeah.
And so the Mearns area was getting hit pretty hard by some out-of-state hunters, and they literally said, you know, I heard them. They said, you know, we're not coming back, you know, so and we don't have time to go chase other coveys.
Right.
And I'm thinking, oh, man.
What a horrible perspective.
Yeah, I'm like, man, and they're not going to be any left, you know. And so I saw them back in the same spot the next day, and I was going to go hunt in that area, and I thought, I'm not even going by there, man. No, so.
I mean, I typically my approach on the Grand Slam is much different. The Slam for Arizona Quail, I'll hunt areas where I know I'm going to get gambles and scalies
and
pretty quick.
If you can pull up a Mearns,
and then I haul butt.
Yeah.
To go somewhere where I think there's going to be Mearns, you know. I don't try and get all three of them in the same area.
It's fun.
Because I don't know too many places like that, you know. And to me, I haven't done it that way.
It is such a special deal. But I guess, do you think that they should change the season dates? Or do you think that would have any impact?
I think the season dates, I think it would be a mistake to compress the season dates. Because all you're doing is pushing more people into a tighter window. You're going to have more social pressure. To me, that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. I don't like the idea personally of a fluctuating limit. A five-bird limit. It makes no difference to me. I'm not a limit guy. I don't care.
Isn't there psychology to it, too?
There is a lot. And that's what you worry about, right? But you don't know
that. You put the limit at 5, and the guy gets 3 and says, well, I got to go get 2 more.
Right.
Or you put it at 15, and he's like, I got 3. I'm good.
Yeah. I'm never going to get the limit.
Never going to get the limit, yeah.
And we talked about that a lot. I mean, this is not a new discussion. It comes up every year, and it came up every year I was a program manager for the small game. Is should we lower the limit? And and there's a lot of discussion.
Yeah.
And to me, I don't care. To be honest with you, I don't care. You got to look at it this biologically. I don't believe there's going to be an impact lowering the limit. Socially, there may be, right? But I biologically, it doesn't matter. I mean, biologically, we could hunt Mearns quail from September until December. I mean, Because biologically, they're developed enough, and most of them are going to get hammered by predators
and half the hunters are going to get hit by rattlesnakes.
Well,
so.
And if you want to shoot, if you want to shoot birds that are 2 inches tall, I mean, you can do that. Biologically, that's probably not going to affect the population because most of those birds are going to get taken out by natural predators anyway before they get to adult size, right?
Yeah.
And people have a really hard time understanding the compensatory mortality, but it's real.
Yeah.
And it's been studied over and over in all kinds of different quail populations, not just Mearns, not gambles, bobwhites, everything you can think of. And it's real. So,
I get the psychology. I mean, in the business world, you can call it the small win strategy. So
if you have a small win strategy, well, you start small so you can actually achieve the goal.
Right.
And then you get momentum and you keep moving forward. So if you hit five as your limit and then you already hit three, well, you're like, I'm almost there.
Right.
You know,
right.
Where if it's 15, it's like, well, that's not attainable.
So I, you know, like this last year, this is how I think most hunters are. And I don't think I stand out at all. It was a below average, if you want to say it that way, year for Mearns quail.
Absolutely.
And I didn't kill a limit.
Mm-hmm.
I harvested probably 15 birds. I mean, I've got notes, you know, and the number of days I went down was very limited, you know, just because there weren't big numbers. I was better off spending my energy and my effort chasing gambles this year.
Yeah. Well, I know that the San Carlos changed their season and their limit for merge quail.
When did they do that?
It's unlimited, and it starts in November.
It's unlimited numbers?
Unlimited numbers.
I did not know that. I hunted up there this year.
Yeah.
And I wasn't aware. I thought their limits were the same as Arizona, as the state.
Yeah. If I'm wrong, but I don't think so. Because I walked into that location and got the information.
I don't think it's unlimited. Yeah. I could be wrong too.
Yeah.
Because I just looked at it as unless I know differently, I just treat it as they've always tried to stay with the same limits that the Arizona Game of Fish has.
Yeah.
But they
do have different start dates.
They do have different start dates.
November.
Yeah, they're an earlier start date.
Yeah.
And I harvest them before the Mearns. And you send a picture out and there's, is that a Mearns in there?
Right.
They're not open yet.
Right. And we're trying to do some fact checking right now on that. So maybe Nate and Alan, you guys can do that. But that'd be good for our listeners to hear. Well, all right. So I guess anything else on just, I guess, tell me a story of your favorite quail hunt this season.
Oh, I had a really good year. So I'll start, and it didn't start out good and it didn't end well. But the start of it, I went up to Colorado and I was chasing ptarmigan and dusky grouse.
Wow.
And hiked up to about 12,000 feet and got sick. So I laid around for a day and a half, and then the guy was hunting.
Will they flush?
They're very, they're very difficult.
I heard that they're kind of a pain for the dog because they don't move very much.
I like them for the dog because, especially a young dog.
They'll hold pretty good?
Well, they hold pretty good, and if the dog does go in, they're going to fly.
So it's like working with pigeons?
Yeah, it's like working with, like chuckers. You know how you got to, when you're running a dog with chuckers, and you have to throw your hat at him?
Right,
That's how ptarmigan can be. Yeah.
Pin-raised chucker.
Right, yeah. Pin-raised chucker. Yeah. So, but no, I started out the season with that hunt and got sick up in the mountain, and a guy named Wolf Guberman, I don't know if you know him or not.
I've heard of him.
So he was with me on that, and I had to pack out early, and he carried half my stuff until we got to a point where I could bail off to the truck to get out, and then I went and laid around at my son's place for 3 days before I started feeling better. So that was the start of my season. The end of my season, we were in a quail spot and with a friend of mine, he broke his foot.
I forgot. You guys were together. Yeah, I remember I called Alan and he said, man, I broke my foot. And,
So the last opportunity. So that's one of those things. But in between there, it was a very successful and a lot of fun. I mean, the bird numbers were good. The dog work was great. And I focused mostly on gambles quail.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I only harvested one scale quail this year.
Yeah.
And scale quail is one of my favorite birds to hunt. It just wasn't worth
the drive and to go for down where there. You're living and all that stuff.
And when I was, when I'm 20 minutes away from birds, why drive 4 hours?
That's like me. I find it hard to run too far.
Yeah. But and when I do go down there, I want to stay for 4 days, or a little bit more of an extended time.
So tell us just on covey sizes, what do you see for gambles this year? Average covey, scalies, and merns.
I have an update. So it says the daily bag limit is 15 quail per day in the aggregate, of which no more than 8 may be merns quail.
Is this for San Carlos?
Just Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
There's no distinction
Well, San Carlos. No, the San Carlos has its own laws, though.
This is on AZ Game and Fish.
Right.
So San Carlos does manage different than Arizona Game and Fish, but San Carlos typically mimics what the limits are with Game and Fish. Yeah.
San Carlos is its own nation.
This says quail may be only taken on or after December 3rd, 2021, when their season's open.
So right. It's different.
So it's different. So that's the state regulations you're looking at, Game and Fish. If you look at San Carlos regulations, they have a different start date. They may have a different bag limit.
Yeah.
According to Ryan.
Right.
You didn't shoot more than eight, did you?
I'm trying to look into it.
You'd have to search San Carlos. They have their own wildlife department
Recreation
here.
And wildlife. I'm looking into it.
Yeah. So the bird numbers that I was seeing, and I think you're right, because the one time I did go down and look for scalies, and we did find gambles in scalies, and the coveys that we found on that one, I can't say I hunted them much, but they were smaller down. They were 15 birds,
right?
20 birds, maybe the top end. And the cover was much different than it had been in previous years.
Mm-hmm.
So I did notice that the birds weren't holding as tight. They were running a lot more, just because the cover where I hunt was less.
And that was which species did you say?
That was gambles and scalies.
Yeah.
In the southern part of the state, gambles and scalies. And then in north of Phoenix, I would say about every covey I ran into was above 20 birds.
Yeah.
And some maxing out probably between 40 and 50.
I haven't done it in the last couple of years, but I'm telling you, I think it's related to rain.
Oh, it absolutely
is. You know, like I worked with the head of the meteorologist, weatherologist or whatever you call them, with Arizona State University for a while on rain precipitation, all that, the historical studies. And
absolutely.
And I just basically, I found out there's such a high correlation.
It's a huge correlation. Yeah. And that's pretty well known for gambles and for merns. And then scale quail is, you look at New Mexico research and Arizona research, and you get a difference between winter precipitation and spring precipitation.
Yeah.
So
scalies can kind of
adapt a little bit better, or they kind of that mid spring, summer, winter, they can kind of adapt to that and see some pretty good.
What are your thoughts? I'm just throwing this out there. What are your thoughts on that second clutch or whatever? So, you know, where they're having.
So yeah, that's a very interesting topic, because
a second hatch.
You look at the research. The research says that it doesn't contribute significantly to the population.
But
the
there's second hatch. Some would say that doesn't even happen. There's not even a second hatch.
No, I know that. I believe that it does happen.
And others would say, well, that's because the mother left or somebody shoveled some eggs in there. And, you know,
so,
like
there's a lot of areas that I've hunted the same.
Because people will say that, there's another hatch. There's at least two or three hatches, you know.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know how significant those are in regular years.
How do you really know if they're second or third hatches?
You don't. And there's some studies that came out on Bob White's I can't remember, but to be honest with you, I can't remember. But what it was looking at that when you do get a clutch, that those clutch, they move between adults. So they don't necessarily stay with the parents. They move around, and so there may be a different group.
Well, one guy might have gotten eaten
right,
up
so they'll
by,
bump
a,
over here, they'll
by
bump
a road
over
runner
here.
Or hit
and
up
so,
by...
So that changes a lot of the, like you were talking about, call or roadside counts.
Yeah.
That could significantly change some of those surveys. Right, if you don't know which chicks belong to what parents, but back to the double clutching stuff. I've hunted enough, so as a hunter, this is what I see. Science, I can't prove it. So as a hunter, I've hunted the same areas since '98, and I know coveys. Like I know where I'm going to find a covey here. And I might not be exact, but within an area, right? And I've seen multiple. multiple sizes mm-hmm. on really good years mm-hmm. that are tied to that same cubby. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you're like
in really good years,
seems,
I think
it seems it like happens. There
in
has
really
to.
Good years, I think they can put off a brood, and then there's enough vitamin A within the forbs that they're able to put a second clutch right. out, even with the successful.
But there's
clutch.
No hard data to support.
There's
that
no hard data yeah, at yeah, all to yeah. support, and it's actually to the contrary. The data shows that it doesn't contribute significantly to the population second clutches.
Yeah.
That's what the data says.
Or does the data also say that there really is no research to prove that the birds are having
No, they do have second hatches.
Okay.
But it doesn't like on a bad year they may fail and attempt again.
Okay.
But they're okay. not but in a bad year they're not going to succeed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So and that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Okay.
But there's no proof that it adds significant birds yeah. to the population.
So, all right, let's talk poodle pointers, and then we'll wrap up with some questions for new quail hunters and whatnot.
Yeah.
So, talk to us about your dog. What are you running poodle pointers?
I run poodle pointers, and I've told people this. I don't know why. It was just one of those things where I was looking for. I came from the lab and the retriever world.
Black labs, golden labs,
and Chesapeakes, and I mean, I had the retrievers, ran field trials, ran the NARA, North American Retriever Hunter Association, or something like that. Anyway, so I ran labs and retrievers and Chesapeakes through that, and really enjoyed that. And I found I was hunting upland birds a lot more. I've always done some of it, but I was focusing more on it. So when I went to get a dog, I was looking for a versatile retriever or a versatile hunting dog.
Wow.
And I just happened to get a poodle pointer. If I would have got into a German short hair or a bees or anything, I think that would have been my breed of choice, right? But that's poodle pointer is just what I decided to get, you know. And I'm super happy with that choice. They're just really good dogs. They have an off switch that most people say that about all their versatile dogs, right? They have an off switch, right? But my dogs will lay around in the house just lay there. They don't get too friggin' spun up until we get out in the field and we start chasing birds.
And,
I grab
and you
a gun.
Run them with NAVDA?
I run them with NAVDA, yeah.
You run with NAVDA. And tell us a little bit about what NAVDA does.
So
and
NAVDA is, it's acronyms for North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association.
So this would speak to your love for retrievers and versatile
right.
work with water.
Right,
and,
right. Exactly. Okay. So the idea is I can take this dog, I can track with it. If I spent the time, you can track wild game, you know, wounding losses. You could use these versatile dogs to do that, and that they do that a lot in Europe with them. And then that they're a waterfowl dog, and then they're a pointing dog.
You know a guy named Dario?
Dario.
I think he's got either Vizsla or But he does all that versatile training okay. and stuff. Like I thought he was in the NAVDA group.
He might be, but that name yeah. doesn't sound familiar. But and so, you know, and the thing I like about NAVDA, it is geared toward you're training your dog to try and, it's not a competition. It's the idea.
It's not as much. Have you done Arizona Pointing Dog Club?
Yeah, I've done Arizona
Pointing Dog. So that's far more competitive.
It's just more competitive. I think that's still a good thing. And anytime you can get your dogs on birds, mm-hmm. It's a good thing. But with NAVDA, you're focusing on, so like natural ability, which is before the dog's 16 months of age, you run them on a test and all they have to do is be able to stop on point and retrieve in the water and track pheasants, live pheasants. So those are the three tests. And
say that again, point, retrieve, and what?
Point, they don't even have to retrieve. Point, retrieve a bumper from the water.
Okay.
So or just go to the water and swim, demonstrate uh-huh. that the swim, and then track a live pheasant.
Oh, yeah. A dog should be able to do that,
right.
though, yeah. I mean, I guess, I mean, you get not all pointers will retrieve,
right.
you know, and you got to work with them to do it. Mine do, yeah. but, yeah.
So you've got to take a little bit of time because it's something new, like to turn a pup loose and say track without them knowing the command, they may or may not do it.
But they naturally would track if they're pointers, wouldn't they? They're just putting their nose to the ground.
So that's, for me, I don't like going through any of those tests until I have a hunting season on them, because they learn a lot of that tracking and stuff in the field.
Absolutely. Right?
And so that's,
if they're
that's
running by sight, that's a problem.
Right. And a lot of, I mean, from what I've seen, you know, the higher headed dogs don't, the ones that do, you do have to work with them. If you've got like a pointer in NABDA, when there's been some that have gone through, you've got to get them to get their nose on the ground sometimes.
Okay.
You know, because they want to run with their heads up a little bit more. And that's what I've noticed. But you run them.
Are you doing all that training out by Dugas?
We do some of the training out there.
Ronnie Horn, you know that guy?
I know most of the bird suppliers through one group or another.
He got his dog from Ron.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Happy's from Ron, too, my English pointer.
Yeah. And then so in NABDA, then you run into, you go to what they call a utility test. And so the dog has to go out and it's got to be steady to retrieve. So when you go out on point, dog points, bird's flushed, bird shot, bird lands, and then you have to send your dog. So it's got to be steady through that whole sequence.
Yeah, that's the part where, you know, Alan was saying, he's like, hey, look, you know, because I've got my dogs trained on right now.
Right.
It's just steady to shot.
Right.
And then as soon as, or really it's a lot of times they're actually doing more steady to flush, I guess.
So my dogs in the testing world, not testing, but in the NABDA world, they are steady all the way through.
Which is pretty impressive.
But on wild birds,
they won't.
I don't expect that because I'm too busy trying to hunt.
Yeah.
So I'm not reinforcing that.
You know, and I went with the Arizona Pointing Dog Club, and they were pretty adamant about that dog needs to be steady. I think it is.
Right.
Be like beyond the shot to like all the way to the release.
Yeah. And then NASTRA is not. NASTRA is just, they just have to be establish a
NASTRA
point.
NASTRA versus NABDA.
NASTRA versus, so shooting. NASTRA is, they run a little bigger dogs. What is the acronym for that?
North American.
National Shoot to Retrieve Association.
There it is, man. Look at that. Yeah. Nate's on it. Man.
Nate's on it.
So Google anyway, so that's there. So that's a little different. So they're running in braces, right, like the Arizona Pointing Dog Club, but they run in braces, and then they're given points for style.
Yeah, I think a lot of the steadiness. Arizona Pointing Dog Club guys go to NASTRA.
Yeah.
It seems like a very natural evolution.
Right. Yeah. And so there's a little bit, but to me, I mean, all that stuff is good.
Because it's all good.
I've got a guy that I hunted with, Brian Rubella, and his dog is a regional, his dogs are regional.
My dogs
champions.
Are related to his dogs.
Yeah. So those are regional champions. Yeah. And through NASTRA, but he hunts, and those dogs are amazing performers in the field.
He drives on Ford.
Raptor.
Yeah. I did a truck little show on him or whatever. Yeah, his dogs are out of the same litter of my dogs.
Right. So the guy I was talking to you about, Ray Tafora, him and John started to kind of had that line, and that's bred all the way down to your dog.
Wow.
So, that's kind of pretty cool.
Well, there he is right there. He had an incredible season. He did. Boy, it was good. Yeah. So
as far as the poodle pointers go, that, you know, the very positive thing, which my wife loves, is they're not big shedding dogs. So
dogs shed a lot.
So the shorter the hair on the poodle pointers, the more they shed, but it's not very much.
Okay.
If they have a longer hair, you don't find hardly any of their
hair.
And
they're big dogs, aren't they? Are they bigger than Happy?
No, they're
here?
50. Mine are both. One's a little under 50 and one's a little over 50.
Okay.
So they're fairly small. And like a lot of breeds, you're starting to get a lot bigger dogs. For whatever reason, people are breeding bigger dogs.
Yeah.
And I'm starting Zona's, to see a lot more of that with the poodle pointers.
Yeah, Zona's a bit more of a what I've been told is called like a pocket pointer.
Right.
Yeah, and English L Hugh.
Right.
And Happy comes out of that L Hugh background too.
Right.
But he's a bigger dog. I grew up with the duck dogs.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so duck hunting with labs and all that stuff. Yeah. So
I translate a lot of what I have done with labs into that versatile point. Like I do a lot of the hand signals and the stop to whistle.
Yeah, that's what I do.
And
yeah.
So I do a lot of that with my poodle pointers too. Yeah. So they'll stop them, which I think is a great command to have because your dogs are running into trouble. And if they're stopping on a whistle, you can keep them out of trouble, you know, and it's a big deal for me. And so I can stop them.
Yeah, I haven't translated that to a whistle yet, but, you know, I'll use the If I really want them to stop way out in the middle of the field, I could just yell, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, and it works half the time.
Right.
But, you know. So
my dogs are, my younger dog is really good about it. My older dog has so much drive.
Yeah.
If it's on something, I can't turn it back. So that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's great. I think it's important for listeners to hear is that if you're new getting into quail hunting, I think that there is a great advantage to jumping into a club, whether it be a NASTRA, Arizona Pointing Dog Club, or NAVDA. There's some pretty good clubs here in Arizona. In the duck dog world back in Arkansas, I maybe I missed it, but there was nothing.
Right.
But we all grew up with buddies and families that had duck dogs, and we all worked together and trained. And I read Gene Walter's Water Dog book and figured that out and just figured, hey, I'm going to adapt some of this stuff. And then I got the Gun Dog book when I got out to Arizona.
Right.
And then joined the Arizona Pointing Dog Club, and it was Marty Elliott and a few other guys kind of showed me some things. And
Marty was there. We were probably running at the same time, I'm guessing.
Okay.
Like 17 my
wife
like
said,
that.
Like, you know, you never even gave the trial world much of a run. Like, I went out there and I picked up on some stuff, and I just said, man, I need more birds, and I need more. I like doing my own thing, and so it was a good connection and starter point for me.
Yeah, and it was really good. I liked the Arizona because at the time I was running the NAVDA and Arizona Pointing Dog, and so my dog was able to run into a brace situation, right?
Yeah,
and then also training for these versatile. The other bird, so it was a really good combination, and they were on pin raised birds.
Yeah,
2 weeks out of the month, you know, just with that stuff. It's not cheap, you know that. I mean, it's not getting cheaper.
Yeah, when I went out and bought my Arizona game bird license.
Yeah,
which is amazing. So this is the first year I'm going to do it, and I can use it on my dogs.
Yeah.
Chucker, quail, pheasant, and I got all my locations.
So the interesting thing with that, you can use pigeons without that permit.
Right. Yeah. I trap pigeons too. Been doing that for a while.
But, you know, you were talking, kind of wanted to talk a little bit about new hunters and how. And so my advice to that is when you're out in the field and you do start walking without a dog, with a dog, if you're out in the field, take advantage of when you see birds, pay attention to the vegetation and stuff that's around.
Oh, yeah.
And start trying to tie those things together with where you're finding birds. Because a lot of people are just looking and listening, or they're just listening, and they're not looking at the habitat that the birds are in. And then if you're fortunate enough to harvest one, to open up a crop immediately to see what they're eating. Mm-hmm. And you can start keying in on some of those things. And I still trying to figure out birds every time I'm in the field. Like, why are they there? Why aren't they here? You know, and so that's something I do every day when I'm bird hunting.
Yeah.
And I don't know any answers, but that's makes it fun for me.
Yeah.
I really enjoy just being out there and trying to figure things out, whether I'm figuring it out right or not.
Right.
At least you're thinking about how things fit together.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and I was up sage grouse hunting with a guy that was from BLM, and he was managing livestock, but he was an avid sage grouse hunter. And that was the one thing he conveyed to me so many times was when you shoot a bird, look around and look at the vegetation, you know, and you think all that sage is the same. It's not. There's like 3-4 different species. And he told me that. He said, you're going to see where you shoot your birds, you're going to see at least two or three different species of sage. And so he said, this is what this one looks like. You know, so he pointed those out.
Well, that's pretty like, amazing. That's like the knowledge of the fly fisherman.
Right, right.
You know, like you, I mean, that's what I was taught.
Right.
You know, like you walk up to the river before you even fish or the lake or whatever. What's on the ground.
Right.
And then you mimic that. You know, what do you see that's in abundance or whatever?
Right.
And then mimic that, you know. That's pretty neat. Well, here's a question that came in is for new hunters is what's the distinctive behavioral differences between gambles, scaled, and merged quail, would you say?
Behavioral difference?
Yeah.
I guess for a new hunter, obviously, it's habitat, right? Where those birds are found, and so like merns, you're going to have typically, and these are all typically, you'll have a tighter canopy of mostly oak and a grass component, and typically north or softer soil types.
For the Mearns.
For the Mearns.
Yeah.
And so that's a tip. I found them in lots of different habitats, but that if I was going to key on a habitat, that's what I would be looking at. North sloping, high canopy oaks with more of a moist organic soil.
With some grass or whatever.
With some grass for hiding cover. Yeah. Scale quail, what I found that's different is I've hunted them in areas where it's almost a monotypical cover of grass, and I don't find as many birds in that situation as I do in areas where it's broken, where there's a lot of, like, maybe 30-40% bare ground with small brush, like 2 feet tall mesquites, you know, with some bare ground in it. For me, where I hunt, I don't tend to find them where there's all grass. There's a little bit of mixture with stuff and open ground.
Well, perhaps it's because some of those birds like to run a little more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know. And then gambels, typically I find those in thicker cover within the bottom of drainages, especially early in the morning when they come out of their roost. They typically roost in the bottom of a drainage, and then they'll filter onto the hillsides to feed.
And they're typically roosting in, like, bushes, trees, whatnot, be the case. And then Mearns would be...
They roost on the ground.
On the ground.
Yep. And I...
Scalies, too.
Scalies are on the ground as well. And they most of... Well, I know scalies for sure have kind of historical roost sites. Like, I found sites where they've been there for a long time because there's a lot of crap on the ground.
I've seen pictures of the scaled quail, like in snow. They're all huddled up together.
And then Mearns, and I don't, this is one of those things, as a hunter, I look at those places for roosting where the sun catches first thing in the morning, so those east-facing slopes.
For which bird?
For Mearns.
For Mearns, yeah.
So they tend to roost on the ground, open grass, with where that sun's going to hit them early in the morning.
And they want to get warmed up.
That's
what I would do if I was sleeping outside.
And so that's one of those situations where that's what I hunt, so that's where I find them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, I'm curious too, like, as far as when we're going to find them moving around.
Right.
Like, for Mearns quail, is it 9, 10?
I typically
Is it for gambles, 8, 9?
So, I mean, I have my theories on that stuff as well as a hunter.
Yeah.
So, Mearns quail, they typically, like, that I'm much more successful hunting later in the day. I'm talking 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I think that's because there's more scent on the ground for the dogs to pick up.
That makes it good for the guys that want to stay up late and sleep in.
And for old guys like me, you know, you got to get your sleep. and then like gambles, they're usually up before sunrise. And you can catch them calling, and they'll be away from their roost pretty quick, you know. And a scale quail.
They're pretty chatty.
They are chatty. Yeah. They're super chatty. And scale quail are too, but I just don't hear their calls as clearly as I can hear a gamble's call.
Yeah.
But gambles, that's the nice thing about them, especially for a new hunter, is you can get out at sunrise and locate coveys just by listening.
Yeah.
Which is pretty
unique. One of the things that I missed early on in my hunting experience as a young hunter was realizing the importance with jumping on gamble's quail and putting a lot of pressure on them to flush rather than to run. Because if you let them run, they're going to outsmart you, and you're not going to see where they're going to go. But if they flush, the chances of them holding a little bit more.
And different coveys have their escape methods.
Right.
Like, of the coveys that I hunt over time, they kind of have different coveys react different to different things, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, sorry about that. He was chewing on some old grease out of the...
But I had one of the best hunts I had this year was in an area, and I didn't understand what happened at first. We got out of the truck with a friend and started walking, and the dogs just hammered point, right? And I thought, oh, they're right here. And we got up there, and there were no birds. And it looked and looked. Then we started just kind of spreading out, and the dogs started picking up singles. So, and this was quite a ways away from where they initially appointed, but, you know, what that showed me is those birds jumped way early. We were talking, you know, just, and those birds had jumped before we got to them.
Wow.
And we didn't even see them. Yeah. And then they had spread out. But that was one of the best hunts I'd had because they were holding so tight.
Yeah.
And they weren't, pressured. They were pressured by our boys. But they went out and they just landed and they were everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those really exciting hunts because your dog would go on point and you didn't know if it was going to be like a productive point or not. Mm-hmm. But it was just like it was just from bird to bird to bird or scent to scent to scent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was, I think we only killed four or five birds, but it was just intense for like an hour.
Yeah.
It was just intense the whole hour.
Too much fun.
It was just incredible. You know,
so. One of the questions is what do you mean by the birds holding?
Holding.
So, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Describe that. I mean,
yeah, that is kind of interesting because when
we can use all these terms so quickly,
right?
And for a new hunter is like, wait, what do you mean?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say is when you're living in this world, you forget about those terms are pretty common, right?
Yeah.
So you don't think other people know. So holding is basically like so Mearns quail, and I'll use them because they are a very tight holding bird. And what that means, it's a defense mechanism to avoid predation. So especially with Mearns quail, that's how they evolved, is just to hunker down. So they just lay down in a single spot, and then they won't move until you physically push them hard enough to get them to fly out of that cover. So that's what we consider holding.
The dog is literally 6 inches or 3 inches
from
the bird.
Yeah. And so when I'm saying hold, I'm talking about where the birds are hiding from the predators.
Like almost frozen.
Yeah. And so that's holding. And all of the birds do it, but in different circumstances.
Yeah.
And habitat is the key to that, in my opinion. You know, if you've got good habitat, in grasses that they feel comfortable where they think they can avoid you once they split up, they'll hold very tight or stay in one place, and you can walk literally right up to
them.
So
behaviorally speaking, Mearns quail are going to hold tighter.
Especially in the covey.
Especially
in a covey group.
Especially in a covey. And they will move, and they will walk through the grass like a rooster or a pheasant would.
Absolutely.
Or whatever be the case. But they're typically going to hold tighter longer.
Right.
And
typically in a covey group,
group.
Yeah. And I do see, not it's going away from the question, but I, you know, as long as I've been hunting Mearns, some of the birds where I hunt have more of a tendency now, it seems like, to move away from a dog.
Yeah, because they figured it out from generation to generation.
And that's been since I've been hunting, right? So in
the DNA, the genetic coding has said, move.
Right. So I feel like I've taught those birds that they have a better chance if they move.
And with the Mearns quail, you'll see them scratching a lot on the ground, digging and whatnot, and you can look for those kind of behavioral patterns.
And that's a good point, because you see a lot of signs on the ground if you're paying attention, and that's a great thing about being a hunter, is being understand your habitat and what you're looking at sometimes, you know. And sometimes it takes somebody to teach you
to
some
point
of that
it out.
But once you know it.
Yeah.
And so gambles do a lot of that too. Well, they'll dig a hole for dusting, and you'll see where they powdered up a spot, and you can see, and I've seen them do that. And so that's for gambles, you see that. For Mearns, you see a lot of the digging where it looks like little golf ball size, and there's typically fibrous roots that kind of hang down.
Yeah.
They dig kind of into the bank.
They got big old claws.
They do.
Yeah.
They're pretty cool birds. And I have a picture where I've got one walking into like where it dug, and then you got a footprint.
Wow.
Yeah, right into that digging, which is pretty cool. But just being alert out there. I mean, it's amazing the kind of stuff that's hard for me to convey to new hunters, because I've been doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't think about it. So, but, you know, most hunters are open to ask questions, you know. For as a new hunter, go out and ask somebody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's enough people that want to see other people in this, mm-hmm. you know. Some people that don't, but mm-hmm. that's all right.
Well, and like we said earlier, those gambles quail will hold.
Mm-hmm.
But they need typically some thicker cover, and they would prefer to run if they can, if they have the option. They're going to run really fast, really mm-hmm. long, and they'll, as the season goes along, it seems like they're just flushing faster further out. and whatnot be the case. But anything you want to add on that?
Well, some of the most frustrating is where the big cubbies get up.
Yeah.
And they get up and they get up. And you know, for me, I have the tendency to just stay on them until they start holding.
May be two or three flushes, though.
It may be more, yeah. And sometimes I just give up. They just won't stop. And those are typically the bigger cubbies that are flushing together, and they just never split up. And so they move. They fly quite a bit.
And so much depends on the cover you're hunting them with.
Yeah. And the terrain and how fast you can beat them up a hill you know.
Yeah, I was telling a story about one of my last big hunts for the season was a covey of about 50 gambles quail. I parked the truck. I look out and I see about 50 birds in a covey, just a great. And it was my last hope to get a really good hunt with Happy, in closing up his first year of hunting.
Right.
And I thought, boy, this would be it. And sure enough, I look around and I'm like, I've got about 40 acres of unbelievable cover. And I thought, this is it.
Nice.
And sure, I put them out, and we went to town for an hour and bagged 9 birds.
Yeah.
You know, and just had the hunt of his life,
right.
You know, for sure. I mean, just the holding that they were doing was incredible. But had we moved over probably a quarter of a mile, or just even some areas just hundreds of yards, we would have been in terrain those birds would have escaped,
so
it's pretty neat. So I guess last question for new hunters, another question that came in is, describe some of the differences between BLM land, state land, national forest, and that kind of thing as far as hunting goes.
As far as access goes.
Access, hunting, just access. Let's
go with
access. Yeah,
so just go with access. So all three of those are open to hunters with a valid hunting license. With a valid hunting land.
Yeah.
Even state land is the one that we touched on a little bit earlier. So state land is open to the public if you have a valid hunting license or a state land recreational permit.
Mm-hmm.
And so Forest Service is open to the public. BLM is open to the public. The only thing that can get in the way.
You see so much private land down there, and it's just – that's part of my headache down there.
Right. And, you know, in Arizona, and I'm pretty I'm probably more respectful. I don't know about respectful is the right word. I don't push the boundaries of that, right? If I know it's private land, there's enough for me, there's enough public land that I know I can get to that I don't even
need to put up
a fight. I don't even need to go and say, well, it's not posted. And because legally in Arizona, you've got to post it, and there's specific guidelines to posting private property to keep hunters specifically out.
Yeah.
It's got to say no hunting, no trespassing, and it's got to be posted every quarter mile, and there's other regulations associated with that. But for me, I mean, 60% of Arizona is public land. There's really
plenty of opportunities.
There's plenty of opportunity. Yeah. You don't really need to push that.
Your typical game officer is really probably not going to mess with you too much if they know it's not posted.
If it's not
correctly posted,
it's correctly, then yeah. But, you know, and there are some situations, and getting to be more and more, where you have private lands that control access to public land,
which is a pain.
It's a pain in the
found that hunting. Yeah, prairie dogs.
Yeah,
and messing around up by, you know, up in different parts of the northern part of the state, where it was just checkerboarded.
Right.
You know, state land versus private, and it's like, how do you even access this property?
Right.
Like, do you get a helicopter? Do you?
Right.
Like.
So most of those, like in northern Arizona, most of those roads up there, just are subdivision roads, which are open to the public.
Yeah.
Most of them.
But then you got to watch out for not shooting by a house and not shooting off the road.
Absolutely.
There's so many the stipulations, and I bumped into some of those guys. I'm like, man, I'm out here with my boy.
Right.
I'm just trying to have a good time.
You know, and they're people are fairly receptive if you take the time, even if it's posted.
Yeah.
If you feel comfortable, which isn't a Western phenomenon, like in the Midwest, right? People are used to going up and knocking on doors.
Not here.
In Arizona, it's intimidating, right?
Yeah.
But it's effective if you're respectful. You go up and say, "Hey, look, I'm here hunting with my boy. Wonder if I can hunt your private land." most people are receptive to that.
Yeah.
But it's intimidating because right as you go in the gate, it's no trespassing.
And,
you know, dogs will bite, guns are handy, you know, the whole signs, you know. And so it's very intimidating.
Yeah.
But people are very receptive if you're if you're decent, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Wade. I think we've covered a ton of it. And so I don't know, we've hit, I don't know what our time mark is, 2 hours. So we set a new record, Wade.
And I get so, I don't even know if we spun around so many times. We don't know where we ended up or what. But, you know, especially on the Mearns conversations, it's just such a, it's such a hot topic, right? And people are passionate, which is a great thing, right?
Yeah.
People are passionate about them and they feel like, you know, that they need to be outspoken about it. And I think that's great. And I think people should be like that. But there's a lot of effort to go in the scientific documents, and they're peer reviewed. That doesn't mean my buddy looked at it and said it looked good. Mm-hmm. That goes out to the science community that reviews those for statistical validity and things like that.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of resource and efforts that goes into those studies, and they should be valued and used to make decisions.
Yeah.
And most people see things from their perspective and not as a whole, right? And your perspective changes as you get older.
Yeah, yeah.
And so.
Well, just as a recap, one of the outstanding things for me that I'd be curious for follow-up would be kind of the BHAG, the big, hairy, audacious goal for quail hunting in Arizona would be to try to rally some resources to do more investigation and clarification on those Mearns quail in the White Mountains.
Oh, it would be. It would be kind of neat just to, for management and for personal reasons.
Yeah.
It would be neat to just see if there's a biological or a life history kind of difference within those birds, you know.
Well, so you listeners are listening in. If you're a wealthy prospective donor and want to help see something like that happen, you'd have my word. I'd help try to see if we could put together some kind of team. I know there's a number of biologists that are kind of moving out of the active work within Arizona Game and Fish, and probably other parts of the country that moved here and enjoy the seasons here, you know. It'd be really neat to try to put together a team to go do a big project of sorts. What do you think that would take? Is that a couple of years? Is that?
Oh, yeah, you'd have to have multiple years. I'd say at least 3 years, right?
Yeah, that would seem to me.
And, you know, then everything research-based-wise is based on sample statistics, right? So you have to have a certain number of whatever you're studying.
Who do you think would find that data is most desirable? Would that be Quail Forever? Would that be Game and Fish? Would that be?
So I think Game and Fish could incorporate in their management decisions, you know, if they had the data. Quail Forever, we did have some support when I was tied pretty close to the Quail Forever groups. And so they had some interest in doing it as well.
Yeah.
It was like with most studies, you've got to try and reduce your variables. And if you're trying to use dogs to track or catch or whatever, that variable is pretty significant.
Yeah. Well, you know, Arizona's had a lot of good comeback stories.
Yeah.
And, you know, from the bighorn sheep to elk.
Yeah.
I don't know in the small game world what that might be, but this seems like, for Mearns are the elk or the bighorn sheep.
They are a special bird just because there's not a whole lot of places you can hunt them in the United States,
mm-hmm.
right? But I do want, and I'll close with this. So I had, when I was a small game program manager, I had a regional supervisor that had retired come to me and say, "We need to stop hunting Gamble's quail. We need to figure it out because their numbers are way down, you know." And that was based on his perception from the 80s, right?
Oh yeah.
And so that's what I was trying to say.
That was boom season for ducks back in Arkansas. That was rain.
But that's what I'm trying to say is you do a lot because to them they're like they saw it at the peak, right? They saw it this glory stage, right? And now they're seeing it at this lowest number they've ever seen. So they're concerned that those numbers will never come back, you know.
Yeah, but so much is that is way out of our control.
Way out of our control. Yeah. And that's how I feel with Mearns, with a little bit of difference.
Mm-hmm.
because the social pressure is more.
Yeah, and, undoubtedly.
And the social aspect of that is I don't like hunting when there's more people. So when you see more people, you think it's overcrowded.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a biological impact of the species?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It can be in small pockets.
But the largest supportive data would suggest no.
It's as for the
climate, it's right. urbanization. It's
for the population as a whole, hunting, in my opinion, does not, and supported by data, does not impact populations. It may impact specific coveys or small isolated areas.
And people could argue the exact opposite, that hunting dollars generated actually goes back in for the betterment
of the
populations and management of
and
it.
That is absolutely true with our big game for sure.
Yeah.
And small game generates a lot of revenue for the department. And the department, Arizona Game and Fish Department, I hope that they start to understand that that's a big, significant part of their income is coming from small game hunters. And I think that that's a growth area that's going to go up and not down with the availability of big game tags going down.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and that's just percentage of interest.
Who's a guy, would you say, in closing, is there somebody in the state, there's a MERNS expert?
So, of the folks that I know, Kirby Bristow.
Kirby, yeah, and he's the one who did the research.
And he's the wildlife specialist program manager in Tucson right now.
Okay, we'll have to get him on the program.
And so he would be able to really dive into this stuff where, you know, this is a really cool report, which I have a hard time communicating about because I'm not an expert in this, right?
Yeah.
And he'd be the one that could just remember, this is what I broke it down into, and this is why we did the study, and this is when, and this was the results. You know, with me, I'd have to thumb through the article and read it right out of there to try to define it.
Well, it's fun meeting with you guys, you know, some of the Arizona Game and Fish guys. And, you know, my experience has been with Arizona Game and Fish overall just incredible in the sense of getting my kids into hunting.
Right.
The programs, the opportunities, you know, from small game to big game. You know, my daughter, 11 years old, bagged a really nice big cow elk this last year. And the Game and Fish were incredibly helpful with that whole process, and it was a lot of fun. And then, you know, sure, I've bumped into a few wild card guys out in the field, you know, that I'm sure are dealing with a bunch of, you know, jerks, you know, hunters. And so they get numb by all that, and, you know, you bump into those guys. But by and large, it seems to me that the Game and Fish guys overall have been the management of the hunting has been a very positive thing.
Absolutely, they manage, which is a really unique model for opportunity and quality, which is not easy to obtain, and they've done a really good job at doing that with big game, I think. And you know, you look at our youth program. If you're going to throw a plug out, non-residents should be getting in on buying a youth license. It's $5, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then when they apply for the youth hunts, it's only the application fee. And if they're drawn, it's a very minute difference in what a resident youth pays.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it may take a little while. I've got my cousin got drawn for his first elk tag at 16. I've been putting him in since he was 10.
Yeah.
And he finally got a tag this year.
Yeah. My son just got a tag for Cal Elk as well.
That's what this is. It's a youth hunt, which my son is now 24, 23. And he remembers that hunt vividly because the elk were bugling at the time,
Early season
youth hunt, and we were calling bulls in within 10 yards. And
He
just remembers that, you know, and it's just a highlight for him. And he doesn't even care about hunting that much.
Yeah.
But that's one thing that just stuck in his mind, you know. So the youth program with Game and Fish is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So we're just keep going and going unless we call it good, right?
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Wade. I really appreciate it and look forward to maybe getting out in the field with you someday. And for more information on this discussion, you can check us out online at azquailtoday.com. As well, if you've got questions and feedback and find this content helpful, maybe share it with a friend, a group, an organization, or for you new hunters out there, some takeaways would be is get involved with one of these clubs. Arizona Game and Fish as well has a lot of really helpful information out there. And then if people want to connect with you, Wade, how would people connect with you?
I have Instagram, and it's just Wade Zarlingo. I'm not hiding anything, so yeah. I just use my real name.
Yeah.
And then email, it's wzarlingo@gmail.com.
Cool. So cool.
I'm not hiding anything. Yeah. I'm just out there throwing it around. So.
Great to have you on the back porch.
Yeah, thank you.
I
appreciate it. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Well, that is it for today. Thanks for joining us. This is Ryan, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening in. To help further our work, please consider making a tax-deductible gift. Visit us online at azquailtoday.com and be sure to follow us on social media for the latest information and updates. Till then, remember to get outside.